It's New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm Richard Briette. I'll be your host today. And today I'm welcoming Lene Austad. She is a PhD and research fellow in philosophy at the University of Oslo and affiliated with the Center for Studies of the Holocaust and Religious Minorities in Oslo. She currently resides in the UK, pursuing long-standing interest in British psychoanalysis. Working at the interface of psychoanalytic thinking, ethics, and political theory, her writing has focused on the themes of emotions, prejudice, and minority rights. Her books include what we're going to talk about today, Respect, Plurality, and Prejudice, a psychoanalytical and philosophical inquiry into the dynamics of social exclusion and discrimination. That is today's book, and that was published in 2015 by Carnac. She's also published Nationalism and the Body Politic, Psychoanalysis and the Rise of Ethnocentrism and Xenophobia. That's 2014, Carnac. Did you edit that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And another one is Psychoanalysis and Politics, Exclusion and the Politics of Representation. That's 2012, also from Carnac. And then Action, Freedom, Humanity, Encounters with Hannah Arendt. That's still in Norwegian, I believe. What year was that?
It's 2011.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
all right. I'm almost done with your introduction. Lene also founded and co-directs the interdisciplinary conference series called Psychoanalysis and Politics, which aims to address how crucial contemporary political issues may be fruitfully analyzed through psychoanalytic theory and vice versa, how political phenomena may reflect back on psychoanalytic thinking. Lene, welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Yeah, thank you very much for having
Thanks so much for joining us. I'd like to start with our traditional question, which is, what brought you to write this book? What was the process and the motivation that got you to write this?
Yeah, I think actually many different things, really. So it's hard to pin it all down.
Sure.
I was even sort of from I was little taking an interest in how a classmate at school could just take sides, so everyone takes sides with this person against the other person, based on no evidence about what the situation is. So mm-hmm. This group phenomena where everyone is totally convinced that this thing is right and the other thing is wrong, mm-hmm. based on very little evidence,
mm-hmm.
And I think sort of more generally an interest in tracking sort of phenomena of small-scale implicit interactions that are part of discrimination,
mm-hmm.
and then how it's legitimate or not legitimate to, sort of, to criticize but based on sort of non-verbal cues, mm-hmm. or so... So in a way, the social standards for what you can criticize and bring up to discussion of what you can't and what just
mm-hmm.
sort of remains implicit in everything. Yeah. And then I think also like an interest in Holocaust historically and third parties sort of declaring that they didn't know anything about what was happening and how that sort of has largely sort of passed or been accepted until, I think, only in the more recent years, at least in many European countries, there's been a critical debate on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's conveniently we've all apparently moved on without really addressing it. And obviously, you know, as I was reading the book, we are so surrounded or saturated by these issues of prejudice. I mean, just the headlines about the migrant crisis in Europe say a lot about what you're working on this book.
Yeah. So I also think really during the course of the work, it became much more apparent or more critical, some of these things, that you had more and more open expressions of xenophobia, of racism, this in various European countries at the same time, and all this anti-immigrant discourse. Sort of exploding, yeah.
One thing I want to say as we talk about the book, I'd ask myself, how would I approach putting a book together about prejudice and psychoanalysis and philosophy? And as I read it, it struck me that you don't shrink from any challenge in this book. The intellectual courage of this is really striking, that you really take on every question that comes up and, address it, which I was really impressed with. I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you talk about the title? Because I think that's a really important way to start. And the words respect, plurality, and prejudice. Why those words for the title?
Yeah, so maybe some people would think it's a bit misleading in that, you know, I could say it's a book about prejudice, but I thought I wanted to keep it. I thought with the word respect, it was important because, yeah, to think in terms of prejudice as a denial of respect, and also to have the, I think the word respect has got both the association to Kant and respect for human dignity, and also to the Black Power movement more recently.
Mm-hmm.
And also the word plurality is sort of referring to Hannah Arendt, where this is a central concept to her as humans being, as always being plural, and I guess that's been overlooked in most philosophy. Mm-hmm. They're treated like just there's one more and another, and they're just essentially the same. And she also emphasizes the importance of plurality for human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it seems to me the book, just to put it simply, I guess, it takes the problem or the question of prejudice and uses a lot of lenses, a lot of resources to try to, I guess, understand it and the implications of it for us individually and socially. Would you say that's right?
Yeah.
All right. So the thing that you start with, obviously, which is important, is this question about the individual and the social and how to sort of navigate between the two and how they reflect off each other. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like? As you pursued this project?
Yes, I think actually I probably started out thinking more traditionally somehow, and then I changed along the way somehow. I realized that I have to be more critical of the usage of psychoanalysis, or that the social has to be more critically reflected on, because there's a way you can put it, the problem, if you speak of applied psychoanalysis,
right,
is there's a way of doing it, which is to take something ready-made and just apply it onto something else, just put it onto the social. And then so psychoanalysis is the master discourse, so to say, that you stand outside of something and you just analyze it. And implicit in that is that you think you've got a perfect grasp of it, or that you're also, to say, objective and neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm doing, emphasizing in the first chapter, I think, is stress on how you never can be outside of it and objective and neutral, and you're in the middle of some specific social situation and affected by all of that, and how do you need to change your thinking to try and incorporate it and reflect on it.
Yeah, and I really welcome that, and I think it's really important. And, you know, this isn't just a sort of comprehensive review of applied psychoanalysis or texts about prejudice. You really analyze and, I think, bring current all of these approaches. But this point about not being neutral, I really appreciated, because it's such a factor for psychoanalysis. This assumption of a kind of neutrality. You say, in many psychoanalytically informed social analyses, it appears as if the idea of the ideally analyzed analyst as an embodiment of perfect neutrality is not a theoretical fiction, but the reality. And I think that's a fantasy that we often fall into.
Yeah, and you could say that perhaps it's already problematic in a clinical situation, but at least when you're faced with more clearly social phenomena than than any analyst or any other would reflect certain very specific cultural etc. positions that mm-hmm. never can be.
Right. Let me ask.
So yeah.
The Hans-Georg Gadamer seems to play an important part in this approach that you take about your questioning of neutrality and prejudice. Can you talk a little bit about how Gadamer played a role in your book?
In a way, because I didn't actually have him in sort of in mind most of the time, but he's there in the background somehow. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's affected. You've got the debate in psychoanalysis whether to view it mainly as natural science or as interpretation, that's more aligned with the humanities and social sciences, mm-hmm. Which I'm sort of more on that side. So. I think that the centrality of Gadamer, he stresses the importance of or situatedness, that we always occupy one specific position sort of socially, historically, and we view things from that perspective, on the background of all specific tradition or social norms. And so the epistemic aim would be both to grasp that, to realize that, and to see, sort of, to some extent, be able to maybe overcome it isn't the best word, but expand one's horizon by encountering other positions and see how those are other.
I guess it involves a kind of humility as one proceeds. Okay, well, You take on the question of subjectivity and absence in the first chapter. Do you think you could tell us a little bit about your approach to the first chapter and sort of how it sets the stage for the rest of the book?
Yeah, because I use the phrase with subjectivity because it's often said about psychosocial studies that there's a studies of subjectivity. But I think here it's important to argue that it's not just about that, but it's about what's absent from subjectivity, and then both individually and socially. So if you think psychoanalytically, it's both the individual unconscious, but it's also what's socially unconscious. So I go on to emphasize that a lot of prejudice is just that, it's unconscious or preconscious, and therefore not acknowledged as such. So trying to talk about a phenomenon that's most often hidden from view. And then I make use of, based on Ferenczi's Confusion of Tongues, and Barlind's piece on trauma and object relations as based on that.
Right. Maybe we should talk about that for a sec.
Yeah.
Because I think I found it really, really interesting and important. And the idea is essentially, that a child isn't in a position of experiencing trauma when their experience isn't reflected back by an adult. Is that right?
Yes. So it makes a crucial point that the trauma itself, it's only as complete as in the third phase, when what happens is that it's denied. So the reality of the child's experience is denied. So just saying, this never happened, and you're imagining it, and you're being hypersensitive, and it was your fault. So, that completes the trauma as being a genuine trauma. First, you've got an intimate, trustful relationship, and then you've got a betrayal of the trust in sort of excessive overstimulation and rejection. Mm-hmm. And then, crucially, in the third phase, it's denied that that ever happened. And the child is forced to identify with that reality, too. Yeah.
And throughout the book, you bring object relations theorists in at, you know, really crucial points. So there was this current of object relations thinking throughout the book, which, you know, I really appreciated. And so you know, the balance theory of trauma, and do you go on to relate that to Winnicott? I think that's in a later chapter.
Yeah, it's also in this chapter.
Okay. So essentially, the first chapter, you kind of make the argument for how the unconscious is a key element that can't be disregarded when talking about prejudice because of how prejudice works.
Yeah. And also also emphasizing the importance of power relations in that. Mm-hmm. So argue that, say, a racist, etc., attack follows the same pattern in that after it happens, it's been denied, saying, no, this wasn't really racist, or it was only a joke, or it was your fault, etc., etc. So, so on the social level, you've got what is unconscious, and you've got power structures in deciding what is socially unconscious. So, well, what isn't illuminated, and what isn't discussed and talked about, what doesn't count as real, sort of socially.
Mm-hmm. And then that's going to raise a lot of questions later on regarding if there is a social unconscious, what is our individual responsibility if we're within that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's a difficult question. I tried to say something better in the last chapter.
Yeah, of course. Knowing you, you don't shrink from that incredibly intimidating question and take it on fully, which is great. Let's go to chapter two, and which I not only, again, you start talking in a lot of detail about primary process logic. The chapter is called Primary Process Logic and Prejudice. So you do this really thorough and exploration of theories of the unconscious and primary process logic, and then really bring home how important these theories are in terms of understanding prejudice. So, you know, what are the primary points of how the unconscious and prejudice sort of connect? What would you say?
Well, I'm arguing that prejudice is sort of governed by primary process logic. So as a parallel to what Freud analyzes in his book on dreams, so that prejudice is they can be conscious or preconscious or unconscious, but that regardless, they would contain elements of primary process logic as sort of signals as the unconscious is active.
Mm-hmm.
In prejudices,
you do a really extensive reading of The Dream of Irma's Injection. How does that sort of illustrate the way that prejudice is related to primary process logic? Could you talk about that?
But I suppose prejudice is not that explicit in that particular dream, okay. But it illustrates some of the processes whereby it's got one person becoming several people, or Irma standing for lots of different people, as is gradually unpacked, and Freud herself. So mostly I would go into that dream as because it reveals and exemplifies all these processes of condensation and displacement and reversal and reversal of affect and timelessness and so as you got the theme of evasion of guilt running through it, it wasn't me, it was someone else.
Mm-hmm. And so it gets to, I think it seems like the where racism as a notion is in, let's say, media is Essentially, no one, really, almost no one says that they're a racist. Somehow it's happening, but nobody knows how or why, but don't look at me, it's not me.
No, it's always someone else.
Right. And I think that's that point about the dream of Irma's injection. It's how it's always someone else that's responsible or to blame, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. That's clearly. And also the process of several people, distinct people, becoming represented as one is one of distinct. So you could think of sort of, because one form of dehumanization, which would be more obvious in a way, is to think like people say you're like a rat or an insect or you're like a disease, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But another form is more to do with making invisible or representing individuals as only a category, or so as not as individuals at all, so as sort of masses, collective units.
Right, and I think a good example of that would be the migrant crisis.
Yeah, precisely.
I mean, at least in the media here, some people are saying it wasn't until the body, it's terrible, photos of this 3-year-old girl's body being carried out of the water. People are saying it wasn't until then that this was considered, I don't know, a human issue in a way.
Yeah, which is very striking. And it was a detail, it was the issue of use of words, because it was sort of journalists being criticized for saying migrants rather than refugees. Was to do with, you know, legitimacy. And got the response that, you know, because we don't know whether the, you know, whether their claim is legitimate or not, we're going to refer to them as migrants rather.
Right. And I mean, so you definitely get into that in the chapter on speech. I mean, I guess the point being that if you say refugee, it's an actual legal term, is one of the elements of that. Okay, well, let's go to the third chapter. On it's contagion, conflict, and ambivalence. Prejudice as a transfer of shame and guilt. Can you give us a sense of what you try to do in that chapter?
In a way, I'm continuing from the last chapter about the primary process and to sort of to trace transfer of shame and guilt socially in prejudice as incidents of magical thinking, you know, putting onto others painful and difficult emotions, and in socially determined patterns. So
it's this idea of contagion.
Yes, make use of Freud's notion of mana in Totem and Taboo.
Can you talk about that a little?
So he discusses that there's sort of two forms of, you could say, sort of touching or closeness, as you got sort of physical closeness, where the idea of sort of magic is being transmitted just by the physicality. As an example, with the chief mustn't breathe on the fire because his power is transmitted to the fire and then to the meat that's cooked on the fire. And then everyone who then eats that meat become deceased because of the chief, the spirit of the chief is so powerful. So you have transmission by sort of means of physical contact. And another one to do with contacts between ideas, which could be by means of words being similar. So cites also examples of taboos on mentioning the name of dead people, fearing that they might come back and take revenge. And and of course it's important to Freud that these are ideas such as these persist in our society as well, that we never wholly rid ourselves of patterns of magical thinking,
really. you get to the idea that the other is an agent carrying something, but also a sufferer. But there's this ambivalence about whether it's one or the other, I think, right?
Yeah. And I in a way, that's centered, sort of, I'm trying to explore the boundary between what you think is a moral argument and moral qualities and non-moral qualities, such as disease, say, that in a lot of this sort of prejudice ideations that these are not wholly separate at all, that these merge into each other. And suppose you also find prejudice discourse in the shape of moral arguments, whereas they're also infused with magical thinking.
Right.
So,
I mean, I think in the States, with the current presidential campaign discourses, there is a lot of talk about, you know, immigrants and building a wall to protect, you know, the country from this invading horde, and the idea that they're going to take jobs. As I was reading this, your book, it was really, sadly, I guess, not difficult at all to see a lot of examples of how each of these elements plays out today.
Yeah. So I also thought, and that's the reason also for thinking of this as a general theme. I think the large extent of historical continuity, really, with some variation. So, which is very sad, of course.
Well, let's. I want to move on to the next chapter, which is, you know, again, not shrinking from a challenge. You take on the question of hate speech, injurious speech, and also the notion about legality and whether it's possible to, I suppose, what would be the question, censoring it?
But in a way, I try to bring the debates beyond that, in a way, to not just argue for and against censorship, because, mm-hmm. yeah.
So how do you bring it beyond that debate? What do you?
That's a bit about where this goes. And actually, it's got a concrete political background, really, from mostly the Norwegian political debates after Breivik,
mm-hmm.
Where it was framed mostly by sort of right wing, but also more broadly, that you got freedom of speech, which is absolute, just, and then you got other concerns.
Just for a second, you're for background for the listener. You're talking about the attack that occurred, right?
Yes, in Norway, the sort of terrorist attack on the government building, shooting over. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it was a right-wing person that was a big reader of a lot of hate-related literature, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, please.
And sort of influenced by what you call, well, Islamophobic, but what you call, mm-hmm. Anti-jihad.
Right.
Who was... But I'm also concerned because after him, some of the views that were aligned with him became more mainstream, really.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, also I think as a result of this opening up, because it was argued that we need to open up to and have all these debates and let all the people who are sort of anti-immigration and Islamophobic, we have to let them speak up so we can have a... rational resolution. And then when you see the result that happened instead was that these views just became more and more mainstream about what it represented, really.
So yeah. I guess the question is, by having a discussion, you actually almost spread the ideology.
Yeah.
And so what's your take on that? How did you tackle this question?
Well, I take it at least one bit of the argument, when we continue that I was arguing about human rights, was that it's mistaken to just frame the question as saying you got a human right, which is freedom of speech, and then you got other concerns. Because if you read the Declaration of Human Rights, you see that you actually got equally the right to protection against discrimination, which is also an absolute right. So you've got actually two fundamental rights standing against each other in this issue.
Right.
So it's, you know, far too easy to say you could just brush one of them aside.
Right.
But beyond that, I think what happened was that people in general became habituated to more racist speech in the press in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so there was also, I found that a bit shocking because I had by then moved here, and so talking to people here who sort of, I was a bit shocked at the level of it. I was sort of questioning whether they didn't react to it, and they said that, well, it would just become normal. So, whereas at the same time, I think people who would then try to speak against it would easily be silenced or harassed so much that they would pull away from public debate. So I think it's more problem because the argument that you should just have lots of freedom of speech, it doesn't consider inequalities of power.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm looking at the passage here I underline. You say, I argue in favor of a need to examine not only directly hateful and discriminatory utterances, but also the conceptual frames that, while in themselves seemingly innocent, lend support to hate speech.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Are you talking about, when you say conceptual frames there, lend support to hate speech? Can you talk more about that? What are the conceptual frames?
For example, the word that immigrant, someone being sort of labeled an immigrant even after many years of having lived in the country and learned the language and got the citizenship. You even got use of the words like second generation immigrant, third generation immigrant. So practice of othering, but which isn't, of course, it doesn't count as hate speech. But so these things would be a question of what kind of people you would place in what kind of categories. And there would be an ambiguity there in the background, in that some words such as immigrant, it's not officially sort of a racist word or also linked with racism, but it's got ideational connotations.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
which,
so...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's all over the place in the States. You know, you learn a lot about somebody if they say the word illegals versus, you know, undocumented. So I guess what you're arguing for is that we all sort of up our game in terms of being able to have a discussion about analyzing things like terms and words and the position that these words imply.
Because the sort of social categories used in that way, of course, they become habitual and then noticeable to many people. But you could ask critical questions about those frameworks, you know, who are put within what frame.
You know, it's interesting because I'm trying to sort of play this out in my mind. if you essentially point out that the word, say, illegal as a way of referring to a person is dehumanizing.
Yeah.
The person who uses the word illegal might say, oh, well, you're censoring me.
Mm, yeah, precisely. And also that I'm just searching something objective, so.
Yeah. So I kept hitting that wall as I thought about, you know, how, and we'll get to this in a later discussion, how to have a dialogue with a person that may be engaging in the kind of ideology of prejudice. And, you know, apparently I'm innocent here because I don't do that. And I'm putting myself in the position of this, you know, person of goodwill trying to talk to a racist or however you want to put it. But, you know, I listen to a lot of, you know, media and talk radio. And I guess as a psychoanalyst, I love listening to people talk also. But it's this, you hit a wall where you can tell someone you're dehumanizing another person. And there's a level of resistance that is almost, I would say, clinical in a sense. Like, you know that you're working against a resistance.
Mm, yeah. So there is something, I'm trying to show her also that it's not quite like, you know, rational discourse, I think, because there would be answers such as, well, no, I'm not dehumanizing, or I don't care, or I didn't say just that, but something slightly different, but I did mean that anyway. So you've got all this kind of slippery discourse. And
right, exactly.
Just changing some premises only slightly in order to go right back to where you were.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so maybe Winnicott can help us on this point. And, you know, I should point out that I never knew when you were going to bring in some piece of culture, like you use Jeanette Winterson at one point, Sophocles, and in Chapter 5 you use Fassbender and his 1974 film Fear Eats the Soul. I think the American version of that title is Ali, Fear Eats the Soul. But you talk about the concept of basic trust. Can you tell us how you relate that to social space and what you do in this chapter?
I suppose it started because I was watching that film and was very struck by it.
Mm.
And I thought that what it does so brilliantly is to show social situations that are just so very ordinary, and then to show them as not being ordinary at all.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine the Winnicott's basic trust is being used to both a social context, then there are sort of lots of social, everyday interactions that you don't notice because you would just, you know, rely on them being there. Like Winnicott says about basic trust, that it's unnoticeable because you're being supported, but you would think of that as just sort of a part of yourself, part of what you take for granted. So it's only if you're being dropped or being, you know, not as there's only a sort of striking absence of that basic trust that would be noticeable.
Right. And that had me thinking about, in American political discourse, the concept of white privilege.
Precisely.
And that, you know, and that's again one of the sort of electrifying elements of this chapter, that these psychoanalytic concepts are so spot on relevant to these social discourses. And, you know, white privilege is essentially about having an uninterrupted basic trust at a social level, I think.
Yes, that's well put, yeah.
Oh, thank you. And so, anyway.
Yeah, so I'm also, trying to highlight that, you know, then you've got a problem with empathy because the difficulty of imagining that it could be otherwise.
And so, what is... Yeah. So can you sort of tell us more about that? It's hard to empathize with someone who doesn't feel basic trust. Is that the...
Yeah, that's my starting point in a way, because if you never experience that breach of it, you don't know what it is to feel that.
Mm-hmm.
So that others, let's say, given the context of this film, the others around can't really imagine the situation of Ali.
I should, just for background for the listeners, Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, is about a, it takes place, I guess, in a sort of working class setting in Germany, and I think it's in Berlin.
Munich.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us the basic story of the film? I don't want to try to do it for you.
Yeah, it's about Ali is a foreign worker there in Munich, working as a mechanic, and in an opening scene he meets Emmy, who's quite a bit older than him, in a bar, and they start to dance,
and she is white, right?
Yeah, she's white, German, and works as a cleaner. And then, then the relationship starts between them, and they get married. And everyone around them, practically everyone, sort of discriminates against them in every possible way, very harshly. Should I go on and tell the whole how the story develops?
Well, I think, you know, go ahead, sure.
Well, because you've got a twist, sort of a turning point in the story where there's a point with Emmy saying, oh, let's get away on holiday from all these horrible people. And when they come back, you've got a turn where everyone is starting to invite her back in to be part of the community with her neighbors and friends and others, while still excluding Ali.
Mm-hmm.
So up until then, you have sort of the two of them against the rest of the world. But now there's a complication in that Emmy's sort of loyalty is tested, whether she's partly drawn to sort of side with the others against Ali, against it. So you've got all the sort of complicated, the racism of the surrounding relationship entering into their relationship as well.
Yeah, so, you end up, he becomes invisible in a sense, and you're not sure whether she starts objectifying him or whether she always did. And then there's the really strange references she keeps making to Hitler. This was Hitler's favorite restaurant. Yeah. I want to go to that restaurant, which is.
Yes.
Fassbender's weirdness. But the other piece in this chapter that you talk about is true and false self. And there's really a question about, you know, is Ali in a state of being a false self? Would you say that is accurate?
Yeah, I would say because of the pressure of the environment, that it's not, that there is no social space that's given to him where he can be. It's a very true self can live and breathe, so to say. Perhaps with the exception of some of the scenes between just the two of them that we see in the beginning, which seem very genuine and a contrast to.
Yeah, it's incredibly poignant, and it is. Fassbender is ruthless. You know, the way he takes these questions on. We have a few minutes left, and I knew it was really ambitious to try to take on the whole book in this one show.
It's good that we've got a lot to talk about.
We certainly do. I wanted to get to... I know that, you know, I read the Philosophy and Politics interview that you did on the website, and I know that, you know, Adorno and Arendt have been really important figures for you. And I don't want to to go without talking about what I thought was really, I guess, kind of intellectually delightful in a way, which was how you use Bion to read Adorno. And can you sort of talk about your strategy with that? What were you trying to accomplish?
Because I start that chapter by talking about the authoritarian personality, which I think is an important study with lasting validity in a way, and it's also important because it treats prejudice as a general phenomenon, saying that someone who's high on sexism would also be high on racism and anti-Semitism, etc. So we have a tendency towards stereotyping and rigidity in general. While also seeing sort of personality as shaped by society, so that it's not just an analysis of individuals, so to say.
And I think it's a question. The authoritarian personality, for those who aren't familiar, it was essentially the result of sociological studies or surveys and tests to try to understand whether, correct me if I'm wrong, there is a type of personality that is more prone to authoritarianism.
Yeah, so it started out being mainly focused on anti-Semitism in 1950, so the Frankfurt School, where they moved to America and did these studies. And then they found sort of links with sexism, racism. So the idea was that, you know, you could have a fascist potential in countries other than Germany, so to say, and to examine that potential elsewhere.
And so I think the idea is ego strength, and what this is my take on it, but whether a person's ego is prone to the kind of freezing of thought that happens with ideology and authoritarianism. It's a way of stopping thought, I think. And that's where you bring Bion in terms of.
Yeah, because there's a tendency that because it's also problematic. I think the idea of ego strength would also be problematic to Adorno himself. In that he would have argued that sort of some of these forms of extreme prejudice could precisely be seen as sort of the ego devouring the object, or sort of the sort of idealism played out in violence against the object, where. Describes in Dialectic of Enlightenment, which are projections upon projections where you don't take anything in. And he elsewhere also emphasizes the capacity to sort of openness towards experience, to listening to the object. And that's where Bion comes in, that I argue that Bion was interested in some of the same phenomena in the terms of like a breakdown of thinking and what it takes for capacity to experience.
In a way, you could say that the Dialectic of Enlightenment. I really appreciated your writing on this, but Adorno's book, The Dialectic of Enlightenment, is really almost you could see as a critique of ego psychology.
Yeah. Although, yes, you know, one important thing about the authoritarian personality is that it also made extensive use of psychoanalytic thinking. But then that was mostly, I think, ego psychology was what was available to him at the time.
Right.
So then you also get a problem arising out of
the problem of responsibility.
Well, as ego psychology, much more being aligned with an aim of adaptation.
Right. And if it's...
And that would precisely be problematic in this respect.
Right. All right. We're going to have to wind up the show, unfortunately. But I want to say, I'll, you know, leave it to the listener to get a copy of this book. The final chapter, you talk about the question of responsibility and being responsible as an individual and in within social space. It's a really admirable way of closing. I noticed that you start the entire book with, you know, reading the definition, the OED definition of prejudice, and you close it with reading the OED definition of responsibility. And so it was a really moving way to close the subject.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to throw in one more point. you talk about the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, in the context of Arendt's The Banality of Evil and the Eichmann Trial, which, you know, listeners, you have to check it out. It's an amazing mashup of concepts and thoughts. Lene, can you talk just briefly about psychoanalysis and politics and what's happening with that organization?
I started it in, I think the idea was conceived autumn of 2009, and then the first conference was in 2010 in the spring, and I was in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And that was actually the book, Exclusion and the Politics of Representation, that became that book,
okay.
The first one. And since then, it's been going on, well, every year.
Mm-hmm.
And then mostly conferences in the spring in several different countries in Europe. And so, yeah, the next one next year is going to be in Vienna in May.
May of 2016, uh-huh.
Yeah. So I also think it's and it's interdisciplinary with many people coming from many different professions, and not just... Yeah, not just psychoanalysts, but philosophers, sociologists, people from literature, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And so actually, in the way of Poe Arendt, in some ways, it's a sort of links with an idea of, sort of creating a space with many different perspectives where you can come together and discuss.
Plurality.
And also not linking to one particular country or one particular group having the dominance, but to,
I think it's a really
exciting... For really listening to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a really exciting project. I'm definitely going to be following it. And I think also your book... creates its own audience in a way. Your book asks the reader to rise to the occasion of being sort of part of this new way of thinking and reflecting. So I really appreciated that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have. Again, I've been talking with Lene Austad about her book Respect, Plurality, and Prejudice, A Psychoanalytical and Philosophical Inquiry into the Dynamics of Social Exclusion and Discrimination. That is from Karnak 2015. Lene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.